Looking for tickets to your next game, concert, or show? Make shopping for tickets more convenient with TickPick, the original no-fee ticket marketplace that brings you the best prices for all the events that you love. And now TickPick is partnering with Zip, so you can shop now and pay later. Zip allows you to shop at TickPick and split your payment into easy installments. Visit TickPick.com or install TickPick on the App Store and use promo code ZIP20, that's ZIP20, for $20 off your first purchase of $199 or more with Zip. Zip can only be used for U.S. purchases, and Zip may charge a fee at checkout. Certain merchant product goods and service restrictions apply. Visit Zip's terms of service at www.zip.co-us. Loans through the Zip app were originated through WebBank, except for Zip-originated loans in Colorado, Nevada, Massachusetts, and Maryland. Check out with Zip at TickPick.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another draft podcast on the Baseball America podcast. I'm Carlos Collazo, joined by Peter Flaherty, who is in a new neck of the woods right now. I think he's out in Arizona getting some pro looks. A true Baseball American. I think Peter's technically on a little bit of a vacation, and he's actually going out there and seeing baseball live. So, you know, you got to love that, Peter. How you doing?
I'm doing well. Yeah, it's a nice long weekend with my lovely girlfriend with a little bit of AFL action mixed in. I figured when in Rome and caught my first AFL game last night, and it didn't disappoint. Chase DeLauder I left really blown away with DeLauder, 2-for-4 with a mammoth home run. So he was really impressive, and same with Ryan Bliss, actually.
So first of all, if you guys are listening to this podcast, if you haven't seen the video that Peter put up on Chase DeLauder, just the sound off his bat in both the videos that you posted, Peter, was so awesome to see. Me and Ben a few weeks ago talked about AFL guys that we were excited to see, and I think DeLauder was near the top of the list, just given some of the time that he'd missed, given how loud the tools are and how good of a hitter he's been. Really, if you look at his entire track record of hitting pro ball, college ball with James Madison at the Cape, it's really astounding numbers. And when you pair the physical tools that he has with that, I wonder how under the radar he's going, just given a lack of playing time in pro ball, but it doesn't feel like that's going to last much longer if he keeps hitting like that. So that was really cool to see. And I guess as someone who's never been to the AFL, how did the AFL experience live up to the hype? Because our pro guys love it, man. They talk about it being one of the best baseball, events you can go to.
It was a really cool experience being my first time. I know it's Josh's cup of tea, but I can see why he loves it so much. I mean, it's a very intimate environment, almost similar to the Cape League a little bit. Yeah. And you purchase a ticket, it's just general admission, and you have, no matter what you're there for, you have the run of the place. I was able to move around super easily, like run back and forth from one side of the field to the other to grab open face of right-handed hitters and then left-handed hitters. There's a great little merchandise booth, because I'm a huge like team issued t-shirt guy. Like maybe it's a little bit of a gear snob move, but I like to get like what the players have to rock. So like they had a nice little team issued booth of Javelina's gear and Scottsdale Scorpions gear. So I snagged a t-shirt. Nice. And then the pretzel I had was an above average pretzel too. Unsalted. Definitely wow. Recommend if you're at Scottsdale Stadium.
Unsalted, and it was above average?
My hunger, wow. my absolute, like, I was ravenous at that point, so that definitely
your scale was a little optimistic at that point, given your hunger.
I was, like, shaking, and I had, like, peanut M&Ms and a pretzel, and that did the trick, but the overall experience was excellent, and I couldn't recommend it more.
That's awesome. Well, I'm excited to get some live baseball here in the future as well. It's been a little bit for me, really, since the showcase circuit of the summer concluded. I guess it's been maybe almost 2 months. It might actually be 2 months, but I'm going to Jupiter this week, so I should get a little taste of that. I don't know if I'll see anyone as physically impressive as Chase DeLauder at that event, but there are no shortage of players that should be exciting to see for me over the next week. We also have playoff baseball starting today. We're not going to spend too much time today on this draft podcast talking about the playoffs. I know Kyle and JJ on the main BA feed, which I guess you're listening to right now, they have a playoff preview. Ben and myself talked a little playoffs in the latest future projection episode. So if you want detailed playoff talk today as we kind of get rolling, those would probably be your better options. But do you have any thoughts on the playoffs, Peter? Are you going to be locked in? Any surprises or any overall takes since technically we're recording this before it gets started?
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing better than October baseball. Like you can feel the weight and significance of literally every single pitch just watching it. And I think that's what makes it, you know, so much fun. And I guess like for as far as World Series goes, I mean, I'll stay a little chalky. I'd love if the Orioles could win it all. I think it'd be a perfect bow on what's been a really, really special season at all levels, because Norfolk just won the AAA championship, and you've seen all the success that their other affiliates have had, and it's kind of the culmination of what's been, I think, years, borderline a decade in the works. So I'm kind of pulling for them and hope they win, but you know, anyone out of the NL is going to be very, very tough to beat, especially Atlanta. I mean, that lineup is ridiculous.
Yeah, I didn't give this much thought the last time I was thinking about the postseason, but this will be the first year we've had playoff baseball with the new pitch clock rules, which will be interesting, because I know there were some moments in the World Baseball Classic that were really intense and really dramatic, and the fact that there wasn't a pitch clock meant those moments, like I'm thinking of the Shohei Ohtani, Mike Trout, AB, where you really have a lot of time to like anticipate what's about to happen. And I'm curious, one, if people even notice the difference since we've kind of had a full season to get used to the new tempo, and just how those moments will impact the players. It's like really high leverage, obviously. I'm excited for it. I think the game is just more fun to watch with the pitch clock, but that's something that I'd kind of forgotten about because it's so normalized now.
I know. I kind of like the idea of having the moment married a little bit. I think it plays way better when it's a super intense moment, and less so if you're in one of these like 8-2, 8-1 multi-run games. But I just love, I mean, like we both said, the sheer intenseness of it all.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, let's get into some draft talk with our draft previews or draft reviews, excuse me, from the 23 class behind us. We wanted to start dipping our toes in the water of the 2024 draft class. So today we're going to talk about a few of the players who are topping our current draft board. You can see this full top 100 of the 2024 class on the site with scouting reports for each player. This is kind of the bulk of the draft coverage is this list. It'll expand and grow. The reports will get updated and lengthened out as we get into next year. But for now, it's a pretty solid starting point to familiarize yourself with the class, with some of the top players to know. So me and Peter today are going to kind of work through the top five players on that list. I think they're players that we're both reasonably familiar with, but I spent the last day or so just kind of watching some video, getting refreshed on a few of these players, and I'm excited to see what you think about them, Peter, like where we agree, where maybe we disagree, what the overall profiles are. I think in the past we've kind of been a little bit down on this draft class. It's definitely coming off of 2023, not as fun just with the profiles you get and some of the pedigrees of the players. But all these players that we're going to talk about today have either electric tools or really advanced hit tools and just offensive approaches. So it should be fun to get into them. And as you guys are listening, if you have any favorites of this group or you have any thoughts on these players, definitely let us know. You can reach out to us probably most easily on Twitter. I'm Carlos A. Collazo. And Peter, what's your handle?
At Peter G. Flaherty. I took the Carlos A. Collazo approach.
Yeah, there we go. So either of those, send us your thoughts if you have any on these players as we work down them. But do you want to just go straight down the list, Peter?
Yeah, I'm up for it. I'm down. And I will say, while I'm higher like you, I think at this point on the 2023 class, just in terms of its overall depth, I think for me, the top of the 24 class is more cheese ball-y. And for those unfamiliar with the term, a cheese ball, like, which I guess doesn't really fit for guys like Kurtz and Bizana because they're in Weatherholt because they're so notable, but a cheese ball is a guy that, you know, you're super, super high on personally and have been for some time. So I'm excited about the top of it. It gets a little murky as we go through with these podcasts towards the middle of the first onward. But
yeah,
I think that's what could make it fun, in that it's a little bit of an open race for guys to establish themselves as first rounders and day one guys.
I agree definitely with that aspect of it. I think from a coverage perspective, the fact that there is not really much consensus on on who's kind of at the top and like a clear order or a clear tier after that, I think will make it a lot more fun just to watch the horse. I mean, typically the horse race is more associated with like the actual college game and the team results, but I think the horse race from the draft prospect side this year will be really fun to watch unfold as well. And I'm sure there are going to be some players that we're not talking about on this podcast episode that 9 months from now will be in play with these top five picks. So just seeing who those players wind up being will be cool. And also all these players are still developing. So the changes we see from guys that we currently have in the 1-1 spot, like if Nick Kurtz, although I don't know, I'm curious what you think. I feel like let's just start with Nick Kurtz, because to me, he's the most well-rounded offensive profile in this entire draft class. I mean, that's part of the reason why we have a college first baseman in that one spot. You don't really get there unless your offensive profile is pretty elite. But just looking at what he's able to do as a hitter, it's not the same sort of contact rates or chase rates of a Travis Bezzana or a JJ Weatherholtz. But I do think when you combine just the size and the physicality and the power that he has, it's a pretty impressive overall approach. The swing I thought was more compact than you might expect given someone of his size. I thought it was plus bat speed. He really produces against most pitch types and most zones. There's no real obvious hole to me that I saw in his swing. I think he uses the opposite field pretty well. He has 1,000 ops or better against both fastballs and breaking balls. The one that maybe you could nitpick with him is the OPS against off speed was just around 900. So still quite good, but over his first 2 years with Wake Forest, that's kind of the one pitch type that maybe you could say, okay, he could do with some improvement there. Or maybe if you have good secondaries or good off-speed pitches specifically, you might want to attack him with that. But I just think it's a really complete offensive profile. And he's also, while you don't have maybe a high bar for much defensively at first base, I think he's, I mean, you've spoken about this in the past as well, Peter, how high you are on him as an athlete, but I think he's a really good defender at the position. And maybe he's even a player that is athletic enough that you could try him in a corner outfield spot if you wanted to. But Kurtz, for me, feels like the safest all-around profile. But what are your thoughts on the big lefty slugger from Wake Forest?
I'm totally with you offensively, at least when it comes to a hit-power combination, and you combine that also with what I would call an advanced approach. At least an above average one. I think it's a, like you said, it's a really, I'd say, high floor, safe pick. I think he's absolutely a big leaguer one day. And going back to his defense, I think he's a, I mean, I'd say it's plus defense over at first. He moves really well and is really nimble for his 6'5", 235 pound stature. He's not as mobile as maybe a Trey Morgan, but he is absolutely a wall over there. for his infielders, and then also, you know, just defense alone. And I do agree that if you need to stick him in the outfield in a pinch, he's probably best suited, I'd say, you know, in left or right. But he'd absolutely be serviceable out there. I don't think that any pro team would try him out there unless they really need to, but, again, he'd be more than serviceable out there, and it's, I'd say borderline, you're looking at two borderline double plus tools, in my opinion. It's easy above average raw power. And the hit tool itself is really special for a guy that size. You often see the, you know, taller in stature guys come with their fair share of swing and miss or length in the swing. And it's the exact opposite with Kurtz. Like you mentioned, it's pretty compact and explosive, and his long levers and sense for the barrel, it allows him to get to really any pitch in all four quadrants of the strike zone. And he's such an impossible guy to pitch to. And we saw it all year in college. And I think, you know, I'm with you that his offensive profile is maybe tops or at least right up there for the top in the draft class.
Yeah, he hit 338, 471, 637 with 15 homers, 14 doubles as a freshman at Wake Forest last year. Then this year, he took a step forward overall, really in every category, hit 353, 527, 784, 24 homers, 10 doubles. Both years, the strikeouts and walks have been quite good. He's walked more than he struck out in both seasons. It was an 18% walk rate as a freshman. It was a 23.8% walk rate last year, which is really exceptional. Again, you mentioned just the compactness of the swing. He's had a sub 20 strikeout rate both years. And I think when you're pairing that sort of average OBP slug with that kind of strikeout rate, you feel pretty confident about it. I think, I mean, even comparing him to his former teammate, Brock Wilkin, watching Wake Forest last year, I got the sense that Nick Kurtz was the better hitter. Even at that time, I think his production throughout his first two seasons compared to Brock Wilkin would make that a pretty safe bet. I just think it's a more well-rounded hitter. I think it's better bat speed, whereas Brock seemed to be more power over hit until taking really a good step forward with his approach during his draft year. And Brock's been quite good in pro ball. So if I think that that Kurtz is the better hitter, I have pretty high expectations for what he's going to do with the bat moving forward. One other thing that I saw, just looking kind of at Synergy and trying to get a little bit more granular with it, against fastballs overall, he had a 1300 OPS. If you just look at 92 plus mile per hour fastballs, it's right in the same ballpark at 1275. And then also looking at elevated fastballs that were 92 plus, I know once you get like this granular, the sample size decreases and maybe you don't want to talk in such broad strokes, but he still had a 1500 ops against 92 plus fastballs at the top third of the zone, which I thought was awesome. We know how common the elevated fastball is in pro ball now. And the fact that it just seems like he doesn't have any real holes in the swing with this sort of impact just makes me feel as confident as maybe anyone in this class in terms of just confidence in the hit tool. And you mentioned the power. So he's just a really polished professional hitter. And I think, to your point, pretty safe profile overall.
Yeah, there's very little to kind of poke a hole in, at least at the dish with Kurtz. I guess, I mean, he was a two-time Cape League signee, a two-time Team USA invitee. I guess I wish that he had at least one summer with Wood, just to see what that would have been like and how he handled the best of the best. But again, that's a very, I'd say that's super, super nitpicky, but it should be a very productive 24 season for him.
Yeah. And I think that's a good point too, because the Wood bat track record is so important when you're trying to project guys to the next level, especially in the seemingly the era of hot college bats across the board and this power inflated offensive environment that we have. Like, just getting that Wood bat track record might make you feel a little bit better about the profile if you had some reservations at all. I also thought it was a bit of a bummer that he dealt with some injuries during the College World Series with Wake Forest, like not seeing him in those big moments like we saw with Dylan Cruz and Wyatt Langford. That would have been really cool, but that's just me kind of getting picky here and wanting even more than we got with a guy who's already done quite a bit at the college level.
No, I'm with you. I will say shout out to a former high school teammate of Peter Flaherty, Jack Winnay, for stepping in when Kurtz went down. But I agree, in that LSU game, it would have been really, really awesome to see him against Paul Skeens and in the big moments in general.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, let's move down the list. I think if Kurtz is more of my like personal favorite of this class, I think the next guy might be yours. I don't think I'm speaking out of turn, but I'll let you take the lead on on Oregon State second baseman Travis Bezzana. Go ahead and break him down for us, Peter.
Well, you're not wrong in that he's my personal 1-1 guy. He stood out to me and popped onto my radar, and it's easy to say now. But after the 2021 summer, when he was a rising freshman going into Oregon State, he absolutely tore up the West Coast League for the Corvallis Knights. And I know the West Coast League isn't a Cape League or an NECBL or Northwoods, but this is typically where, you know, a lot of the West Coast kids will play. Obviously, it's in the name. And then some of the more impressive rising freshmen. So it's still a really good Wood Bat League. I mean, like this year, when looking at guys in the West Coast League, I'd think, you know, players who did a lot less than Bezzana had great summers. Bezzana hit 429. And this is after his high school senior season. He hit 429 with 18 doubles, 5 triples, a home run, stole 18 bases, and walked almost as much as he struck out. And I was like, who is this kid? And I kind of dug deeper. That's when he became a personal cheese ball for me. And then ever since, he's just torn it up. He hit 306 as a true freshman in the Pac-12. I'd say exploded this spring, where he hit 374 with 20 doubles, 11 home runs. I think the power and the impact really really shined this spring, and he also stole 36 bases, walked more than he struck out. I mean, he's without a doubt my personal 1-1, and I could talk probably about Bezzana. If it was me and Jeff on here, we could probably do 2 hours on him. But I'll try and keep it to a couple minutes. Like, the approach is off the charts. He is so, so explosive. Like, I mean, he's the definition of explosive in the box. It's thunderous bat speed. The feel for the barrel is, I'd say, double plus. And the pitch recognition skills and bat-to-ball skills are just off the charts. It was a 92% in-zone contact rate, 94% when focusing just on fastballs. I give the pure hit tool. I mean, I know that a 65 is not a real grade technically.
Hey, 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 not with me, Peter. I'm all for half grades. So if you want to throw a half grade out there, by all means, throw a half grade out there.
It's without a doubt a 65. The power is no doubt above average. I mean, he's a double plus runner, I'd say. And what makes his base running ability all that more effective is his baseball sense. Like, the baseball IQ is off the charts. He picks his spots to run. He knows how to run. He has a great jump league technique that he's used. And then the on-field makeup, again, is just off the charts. Like, I had the privilege to watch him this summer in the Cape League, in which he hit 375 with 14 extra base hits, same number of walks as K's, 14 stolen bases, won the league MVP. I had the privilege to watch him all summer. And, I mean, there were games when his team was down, you know, 7 or 8 runs. The game was out of reach at that point, and it's summer ball, so it's really easy for everyone to kind of become lax and not really care, for lack of a better term. And Bezzana, in these, like, silent nights, so to speak, he'd be the only voice you'd hear on the field, in the dugout, encouraging his pitcher, encouraging his teammates at the top rail. And this isn't, like, eyewash, like, hoping, like, scouts will see this, hoping guys will pick up on it and slap a good makeup grade on it. Like, yeah. It's genuine. It is who he is. And I think offensively, again, it's he's going to rake his way to the bigs. I think defensively, he's more of a second baseman. The arm strength is there. I mean, he was getting on the mound at Driveline this summer and just, like, ripping a 92 just for fun. It's above average arm strength, but I think the actions probably work best at second long term. But he is, I mean, he's my personal 1-1 for sure.
Yeah, I love that, Peter. It's fun hearing you get really excited about a player that you've had a lot of like front and center time in person seeing. I mean, you make a really strong case for him as the 1-1 in the class. The track record and the production speaks for himself. He does have the benefit compared to Kurtz of playing a non-corner defensive position, and it sounds like he's going to have no trouble sticking there, just given the speed and the athleticism. He has hit over 300 both years in the conference formerly known as the Pac-12. Last year it was 374, 500, 622, went from 6 homers to 11 homers in his sophomore campaign. So I have a few questions about Bezzana. So I haven't seen him in person like you have. So it feels like he's the type of player that you just fall in love with once you watch him play on a daily basis, because of that on-field makeup, because of just his style of play, how much of a gamer he is, in addition to all the tools. But sell me on this. His swing is a little bit odd to me. And it's not to say that you can't do it with an odd swing. There are a ton of big leaguers who don't have a swing that you would necessarily teach a player learning how to play baseball. It's a little crouched. The bat tip is pretty extreme down behind his shoulder. It's a sizable leg kick. It just doesn't ultimately look like the most orthodox swing. And then also on the defensive side, I was watching some video of him, and I don't know how common this is for Bezzana, but he throws from a low slot kind of a lot, or at least in the video that I was looking at. So sell me on some of these maybe mechanical oddities with him not being, not being really anything that I should be too concerned about.
Yeah, no, I'd say with the swing, of course, it's an unorthodox setup. You cite that kind of barrel tip and bat tip. It is weird to see, and you're like, okay, how is he going to make it work? And I think the simple answer, at least for me, is, like, I mean, it worked all spring. It worked all summer in the Cape League against the best of the best. Like, if there was a reason to change it, I'd say that he should probably go away from it, but he's done nothing but dominate at all levels with it. So I think, like, it's one of those cases where, I mean, if it works, it works. You kind of see these, you know, they're few and far between, but these guys with weird setups or weird swings or weird timing mechanisms. And you're like, I wonder how it works for him, but he just makes it work. I think Bazan is next in line for that list with this like barrel tip. It almost looks like, you know, I don't want to say stiff because he's super, super athletic, but it looks almost uncomfortable and he just makes it work time and time again. And then I'd say defensively, I think that's probably why he fits best at second base. Like, I think the arm strength would play well at shortstop, but it is a funky slot, as you mentioned.
So is it just the normal, like, for me, I think it was every time that he had his feet set, he was just dropping down a lot lower than you typically see with players. But he also made some plays on the move where he was throwing from a slot that is more like typical. So it just seems like that's the most comfortable slot for him for whatever reason.
Yeah, I think when on the move, again, it's a baseball cliche, but it's sort of like he'll just go where the baseball and the play takes him in terms of throwing and release. And then, as you mentioned, when it's time to get his feet set and it's a slower developing play, more routine, I think that's when he'll drop down. And I mean, I think he was tried out in the outfield a little bit this summer. A little bit to my dismay because he was in left. I wish that he was in center and they just would have let him run around a little. But I think it would be interesting to see him out there, which it won't happen this spring. And I'm not sure if shortstop will either, another position. I was just curious to see how he would have handled because Elijah Hanlon, the Washington State transfer, will hold that down for the Beavers. But defensively, I do think he's pretty solidly a second baseman. And then the swing and the operation, it just works for him. And he's super, super intelligent, like, and very, I don't want to say metric oriented because it might make him sound like all he cares about is the metrics, but he's very knowledgeable with these new age data points and numbers, especially like the blast motion and drive line. And it really, really helped him last summer, even, you know, add more bat speed going into his sophomore season. So, just super intelligent all around.
So last question I have for him, because it seems like there are some similarities to Bazana and Weatherholt that maybe we'll get into as we talk about JJ Weatherholt next, but for both of these players, for Weatherholt and Bazana, it feels like there's not a ton of physical projection remaining with them. Would you disagree with that comment? Or do you think that they're at least reasonably close to maxed out? And so how much, I guess, power uptick would you expect at the next level? Because I think that's another area, and maybe I'm just here playing devil's advocate with you, with Travis Bazana, or trying to get a little more nitpicky, which can get annoying at times, but I think that's what you have to do with the top players. But what stuck out to me too is most of his power just coming to the pull side. In college, like, I would feel a little bit better about an above average or plus power projection if he'd shown a little more opposite field in-game power. How do you view like the power coming for him, the frame in the future, and his ability to drive the ball with authority to the opposite field?
It is definitely to the pull side, like most of his power production, especially in putting balls over the fence. And I'm with you that physically, more or less, that both of these guys are finished products. I think what has me taking Bazana over Weatherholt, and it's like, I mean, it's as close as it can be, but I think there's a little bit more impact with Bazana. He's more explosive. And then some of these little intangibles, like, I think just like have had me fall in love watching him play, which also could, you know, sell me a little bit over on him over Weatherholt. But I'm with you that it's definitely above average power of the pull side. I don't think it's as much to the backside, but he will shoot the left center field gap and put balls into the opposite field gap. I'd say I saw it a couple times this summer. But you're definitely right in that most of the impact and damage done is to the right center gap and over.
Yeah. All right. Well, you've got me more excited about Bazana than I think I was before this podcast. So well done, Peter. Let's move on.
I was going to say too, he was ineligible for the Team USA collegiate national team because he's an Australian citizen. I think that one, obviously, if he was a US born citizen, or just a U.S. citizen, he would have been a two-time member of the collegiate national team, which would have enabled you to get a live look at him. Exactly. And if that were the case, I think he would be your 1-1.
Interesting. Okay. Well, this is a fun conversation because now we're going to JJ Weatherholt, who I did get that live look with Team USA. And part of the reason I am so high on Weatherholt is because, again, I saw him really good in person. And I think this is an interesting case of like information asymmetries, how our live looks impact how we think about a player and potential biases that can create that we need to at least take note of. But I love JJ Weatherholt. It was just a monster for West Virginia last year. His freshman season, he hit 308, 411, 471, five home runs, a really good season for a freshman. And then last year, he just went nuclear. I think his 449 average led D1 hitters. Correct me if that's not right, Peter, but I believe he led all hitters in average with a 517 OBP, a 782 slug. He homered 16 times, doubled 23 times, and added 35 bags. So really just a phenomenal season. He was a player that I was kind of considering for Golden Spike semifinalist votes. I think he was pretty solidly like a top five-ish player in the class last year, or in the country last year, just on performance alone. What really jumps out to me immediately for Weatherholt is just how awesome the spray chart looks. I mean, it's impressive contact ability to all fields, where I was just kind of ragging on Bazana a little bit for his all fields power. Like, I don't have as much questions about Weatherholt's ability to drive the ball over the fence to the opposite side. So that's maybe one area where I would go Weatherholt over Bazana. I also just think that, like Kurtz, I don't have an obvious hole or nitpick for him offensively. It's really good contact. It's a really good approach. It's similar chase and miss rates overall to Bazana, who we were just raving about previously for those traits. All pitch types, he's done a lot of damage and performed at a high level. I think that the spread between his average exit velocity and his top end exit velocity just makes me feel very comfortable about the amount of power he's able to get to. Like his top end exit velocity markers are pretty close to what Bazana's were last year, but his average exit velocity was about four ticks higher. So I just feel like he has incredible feel for the barrel, the adjustability of the swing within the zone. And watching him live, what really jumped out is his hands are strong and the ball comes off really heavy, if that makes sense. Like, much louder contact than I was expecting, because he's not the biggest player. He's sub 6 foot, pretty strongly filled out, and the hands and forearms are really strong. But I was just pretty blown away with the contact quality and the approach overall offensively. I have less feel for him defensively and as a runner now, just because when I saw him in person, he was dealing with a hamstring injury. He wasn't playing defense. He wasn't even really running out of the box. But again, he did steal quite a few bags when he is healthy. It sounds like he's a pretty good runner overall. So I'm pretty all in on JJ Weatherholt at this point, and I think you can probably tell by me talking to him. If I was picking, I might take him over Bazana, but a lot of that is just comes down to the fact that he's the one that I've seen in person and it was a good look. So tell me where I'm wrong on Weatherholt here, Peter. What are your thoughts on him overall? I'm sure you like him too, but we're nitpicking these guys here.
Well, I was going to say, hearing you talk about him and then where I was going to go with it, I might convince myself that Weatherholt's now my 1-1. that's like kind of like how close it is, I'd say, right now at the top.
Yeah, I agree.
I mean, like you said, it was a career year at West Virginia. He was a guy that I know you and I were both talking about in terms of, you know, the Golden Spikes Award. There were scouts that I talked to this spring that said if he was eligible for the 2023 draft, that they'd take him in the top 10 overall picks. And I think there's an argument to be made that regardless of class, that he last year was the best pure hitter in the country. I think it's 80 grade bat to ball skills. If you can put a grade on it, I think the end zone contact rate, I had looked it up this morning and yesterday, I think it was 94% overall. He doesn't miss anything. He doesn't miss against spin. He hammers heaters. You want to talk about someone that's impossible to pitch to. And it's Weatherholt, and it's super whippy barrel through the zone. It's easy bat speed. And like you mentioned, and it was a good point because it brought me back to, I would say I was lucky to get a live look at him this summer on the Cape, because it was before Omaha and after and before Omaha and before he went to USA, but he drove a couple balls with authority into the left center field gap, and the ball does really explode off the bat, like you said. It's super easy bat speed, a great operation, and he hammers it to all fields. And also, when talking about the makeup with Weatherholt, one, I know for a fact that he is an excellent human being, and two, with nowadays, it's so easy for guys to shut it down for a variety of reasons in the summertime and after their college seasons for whatever it may be. But with Weatherholt, he went to Chatham before Team USA, which isn't totally uncommon. A lot of guys will go and play in the Cape before USA. And so he went before USA, played for USA. And this is, he went to USA with this tweaked hamstring and this nagging hamstring. And so everyone was surprised, really, even when he went to USA, and they're like, wow, this kid's, you know, a crazy gamer, you know, super impressive. And then after USA, he came back to Chatham for a few more games. And everyone was like, holy cow, like this kid is a baseball nut. He is a baseball rat through and through, which I thought was really admirable, kind of his summer path and the fact that it was all self-motivated and he did that on his own. It wasn't an advisor getting his ear doing it. It wasn't Coach Mazie at West Virginia. It was all just Weatherholt. So I think that stood out to me. And like you said, I think he's a plus runner. I think Bezzana's baseball sense, at least like in terms of on the base paths, from what I've seen in the two, I've had way more looks at Bezzana though. I think I'd lean Bezzana there. But when you talk about all fields and impacts to all fields, I think it is Weatherholt. And I mean, I'd say that the hit tool right now is comfortably, in my mind, a 70. The power, I'd say, is solid average. And from a pure runner standpoint, I got a runtime pre hamstring injury, and it's without a doubt plus. So it's going to be really interesting, this arms race up at the top, this with these three guys especially. And it's going to be very fun to see how it shakes out, because I think that Weatherholt, again, defensively, is second baseman. He's got decent actions over there. I think that comfortably scouts and probably us in the industry agree, and we'll end up settling on both of them being second baseman long-term.
Yeah. I feel like that part of that right there is kind of the reason that this class just doesn't seem quite as exciting. It's not totally uncommon for there not to be a ton of shortstops in the college class, because a lot of those, like, no doubt shortstop prospects who also have elite offensive profiles just go straight out of high school. But part of the reason last year's class was so exciting is because we had a number of players who were at least playing shortstop in college, even if you thought that they were going to move off the position pretty quickly into pro ball. But with these guys, they've mostly played second base. It sounds like both of them are just going to continue to play second base and rake. But yeah, Weatherholt is exciting to me. I'm just always kind of impressed with just the adjustability of the swing within the zone to get to different pitches, to put the barrel on the baseball at different parts of the zone with different depth, whether that's out in front or waiting back on the ball. From 2022 to 2023, he started putting the ball in the air a lot more frequently, and that kind of helped him jump in homers as dramatically as he did. So I just think it's a really polished, again, like Kurtz, like Bezzana, like a really polished overall offensive approach with sneaky thumb. So a really fun hitter for me. And I mean, I might be talking myself into liking JJ Weatherholt over Nick Kurtz. And I really like Nick Kurtz's overall offensive ability. So you're right. It is like super narrow and super close with all these players here at the top. But yeah, any last thoughts on Weatherholt before we move on? Cause I do feel like there might be a little bit of at least a mini tier break here with our next players.
Yeah, I think that there might be a mini tier break, at least like a minute one. Like, I don't think a pitcher is going 1-1 again this year, or maybe for a while. And then when you start to get into the premium position guys, like, I mean, not to get too far ahead of myself, like that is where Honeycutt with a really productive,
say, this is Vance Honeycutt, North Carolina outfielder.
Yeah, I think that, like, I mean, we'll talk about him next. I think that's where he could separate himself. But again, with Weatherholt, like, I mean, I think he is like all of these hitters that we've talked about so far are super, super well-rounded in their profiles. But I mean, I think I might give him the nod right now for the best one, even just talking about him, like, you know, 80 swing decision, 70 pure hitter, like the power is definitely going to play at the next level. Like I'm trying to think of when I watched him on TV or in person where he didn't generate quality contact. And I really can't think of,
I'm not sure. I haven't been able to see enough BPs to see what his raw power grade would be, but he just seems like one of those Bregman type players that even if you don't think the raw power is super loud, he is able to get to everything he has in game at a level that's just really impressive and hard to, like, you don't see it too commonly. So I'll be very curious to see next spring what sort of like raw power and future power grades that people are putting on him.
I think my whoa moment with Weatherholt was my first live look at him ever, which was this summer in Kituat. I was so excited. I woke up like it was Christmas morning, but it was his first at bat. And I was with you, or not with, but like similar sentiment with, you know, the raw power and seeing how it would play. In his first at bat, he got, I think it was 92 or 93 on the outer third. And he just caught it deep, let his bat speed and feel for the barrel work and hammered it into left center field. And at Lowell Park, it's not a graveyard, but the ball doesn't fly by any means. And he short hopped the fence. And I was like, okay, like, you know, this is for real. Next at bat, same sort of pitch on the outer half, lace the line drive to left. And it was 4 for 4 in terms of barrels.
Yeah, it's been impressive every time I've seen him as well. So he's a fun player. I'm just excited to just be able to bear down on him more next spring. Cause obviously last year I wasn't really focused on him too much, but it was hard to ignore what he was doing just given the overall offensive performance in line. But let's move on to more my neck of the woods, UNC, going to the Tar Heel player, Vance Honeycutt, like I said, center fielder for the Tar Heels. He had a really loud freshman season in 2022. Some of the best power and speed in the country. And to do what he did as a freshman really turned everyone's heads. I think he put himself sort of in this 1-1 position in the 24 class really quickly. He hit 296, 409, 672 with 25 home runs, 29 stolen bases. Like, you would not find a lot of players who had that combination of just slash line home runs and steals in the country. It was a pretty electric second half too. I think most of his power came in the second half. He really turned it on and started going nuclear. That was fun to see. The big question with him was the strikeout rate and the overall contact. It was a strikeout rate nearing 30%. He cut that down pretty significantly year over year, but maybe didn't have as good of a year just in terms of overall production. His sophomore season, he hit 257, 418, 492, 12 home runs, 19 stolen bases. So not as loud on the counting stats, but I was encouraged with just the increased contact that he was able to make. And then we haven't even touched on it yet, but I think in terms of profile and tools, Vance Honeycutt would be the player who teams want to take high in the draft because he is an elite athlete. He's a great defender in center field. He's a great runner. He has raw power. And I think the separation between Honeycutt and all of the players we just talked about, the first three college hitters, is just confidence in the hit tool. Like, what sort of a hitter is he really? How much is he going to swing and miss? But Honeycutt maybe has the most exciting tool set in the class. On the college side, what are your thoughts overall on Honeycutt, Peter? How has your opinion of him evolved as he's kind of progressed throughout his brief 2-year career with the Tar Heels?
Well, at this point, I think that we're talking about the first guy who is going to stick at a premium position and has legit 5-tool upside, which is going to be really, really appealing for teams. I think that the key for Vance, like you said, is going to be finding a balance between that power production that he had in 22, which came with a lot of swing and miss and a lot of strikeouts, versus this improved approach, improved bat to ball skills, which came with less power production, kind of finding somewhere in the middle. I think that's the biggest key for him going into 24, where he can, you know, find this happy medium, because in 2022, his K rate was 36.4, which was astronomical. And he cut that down by almost a full 10%. It was 26.7 in 2023. And the miss rates were way down across the board.
Was that strikeout rate? No, you said K rate, but I'm looking at K rates that are different. So I'm confused.
Maybe I'm off then, but the K rate was significantly down in 2023 compared to 2022. Same with the miss and chase rates. The chase rates, honestly, like the overall approach with Honeycutt, he's never really, like, I'd say, chased a ton or expanded the zone too much. It's just been struggle.
Yeah, the chase rate's pretty good. It's 18% overall between 22 and 23, which is really, I'd say, good. Like, it's not a bad chase rate at all. Sub 20 is always pretty solid for me.
Yeah, most of the Ks in 2022, I think most of his struggles and swing and miss came obviously against off speed and spin. Changeups in 2022, the miss rate was 42%. Against any sort of spin, it was 35% plus. Even fastballs, it was 26%, which is, you know, I'd say for that pitch type, a lot higher than you'd be looking for. And he sliced all of them coming into this year. But not to harp on, like, I'd say some seemingly minute measurement, but like you said, he's an elite defender in center field, sick athlete, great body. And I think he's like 6'3", 190, covers a ton of ground in either gap. Like, he is a slam dunk to stick at the position. And we saw in 22, the type of upside he has at the plate, even with all the swing and miss, he had 25 bombs, 29 bags, quick hands at the plate. I'd say that, correct me if I'm wrong, that most of the power prowess is to the pull side. Like, I've seen him shoot the right center gap.
Yeah, it's funny that you say that. Field. I looked at his spray chart, and most of the power does come to the pull side, but there is this little sliver of home run production to the right center gap. And if you've been to the Bosch at all, there's definitely a very steep curve in the wall in the right center gap to allow a little bit of a power alley there if you're a left-handed hitter. It's a great park for you, but it was funny having gone to the Bosch so often when I was at school there and just seeing so many players hit home runs to that kind of shallower right center part of the park, just seeing how basically all of his home runs to the opposite field are towards that right center gap. So I think I would imagine a strong part of that is just because he's playing in a park that allows him to go deep there, but it seems safe to say that most of the power to this point has gone to the pull side.
Yeah, and I mean, it's super quick hands. Like, he's tooled to the max, looks the part. Like, I mean, you look at him, and I think, you know, you think big leaguer. I think it's just, again, the key for him is going to be finding that blend between approach and power production. And I think, you know, I know that the staff there is confident in him to do it and to kind of finally put it all together, I'd say. And it's going to be really interesting because, again, I think that with a strong season, even if the numbers in the back of the baseball card look more impressive with Kurtz, Bizana, or Weatherholt, like, if Honeycutt is able to go 20-20 and hit around 300, a respectable K walk, the defense is always going to be there. The raw speed is always going to be there. I mean, it's going to be a very interesting lead up to the draft when it comes to the 1-1 discussion, because he'll be in the thick of it regardless, barring some like dud. Like, he'll be a name that's probably thrown around in that range for the entirety of the cycle. But if he's able to put it all together, he is going to be arguably the favorite.
Yeah, it'll be really interesting to see how that unfolds, because I think he does have two things going against him, and really everything else you can maybe say is in his favor. The fact that he's never hit over 300 in a season, I think scouts are really going to want to see him hit over 300 if he's going to go in this top five range where his tools would certainly place him. And then all of the other hitters we've talked about are left-handed. So it's not a huge deal that he's a right-handed hitter. Like, if you're a great hitter, you're a great hitter regardless. Like, Dylan Cruz and Wyatt Langford didn't really get penalized because they hit right-handed, but it is a factor that maybe if you're not as confident in the hit tool, you'd rather him be a left-handed hitter just so you get more advantages in your matchups at the next level. But I do think the next year, if he's able to hit over 300, it would give teams a lot more confidence in the hit tool. I think compared to really all the players we were talking about before, I haven't seen the sort of versatility of his swing, the ability to kind of manipulate the barrel in the zone. A lot of the time, it seems like it's the same swing with Honeycutt. Like, I just would like to see him show a little bit more adaptability within the zone. You mentioned the swing and miss versus secondaries and breaking stuff specifically. His production, this is his first 2 years at UNC. His production against fastballs was a 1054 ops. Against 92 plus velocity overall, it was 926. So both good numbers there. Against off speed specifically, it was a 1234 ops. And then versus breaking balls, his worst category of these three, 893 ops. So I think whether it's a swing issue or a pitch recognition issue, he does show some tendencies to kind of get out front and swing over the top of breaking balls that are down in the zone or below the zone. So maybe that area specifically as a place to improve. I'll be watching that next year. But I mean, when he does hit the ball, he hits the ball in the air pretty consistently. I think that helps him sort of maximize the power production that he's been able to show in college so far. I mean, especially his freshman year. So there are a lot of things to like with Honeycutt. And like you had said, to start off your sort of combo with him, like the defensive profile is really elite. The amount of highlight reel plays that he's made over the first 2 years is really quite shocking. He's had a number of really impressive snags at the wall, a couple home run robberies. I think he has great routes and instincts in addition to just really impressive athleticism and pure speed that should make him a fairly dynamic center fielder, regardless of what the bat is. So there is some sort of like fallback, even if he's not like an elite hitter, you still think you can get some value with him given the defense, given the speed, given the raw power.
Yeah, no, without a doubt. And again, the defense is going to be the calling card with Vance. But with you, I think you made a great point with the breaking ball. And I think the swing adaptability that you do see with someone like Weatherholt, the ability to adjust rather quickly, that hasn't really shown through yet with Honeycutt. There were flashes. But again, against spin will be the key for him, I believe, going forward.
Yeah, so he'll be super fascinating to see if there are any changes that we pick up on very early in the season and just what the performance looks like overall. Because in terms of pure tools and athleticism, I think he's in a league of his own among the players we talked about so far. At least I would make that case. If you want to push back against it, feel free, Peter.
No, I was going to say as a pure athlete and quote unquote tooled up, as far as that's concerned, he's far and away number one.
Cool. All right, let's move on to our fifth and final player for this podcast, and we get to change things up a little bit. We've got a pitcher on deck. It's been all hitters for the first four, but we're moving down to number five, and that's Brody Brecht, Iowa right-hander, who just has elite pure stuff. So maybe waiting on a little bit of the polish. His first year at Iowa, he mostly pitched out of the bullpen. He had one start in 17 appearances, 3.18 ERA over just 22 and a third innings. In those innings, he did rack up 45 strikeouts, which is impressive. Maybe the 25 walks you don't want to see. Followed that up with the 2023 season where he moved into the starting rotation for Iowa, posted 3.74 ERA over 77 innings. Still a ton of strikeouts, a ton of walks, 109 Ks, 61 free passes issued. I mean, he's got a fastball that averages 97 and 98. He's got a slider that seems like one of the better pitches in the country. Where are we at on Brody Brecht, Peter? And I guess I feel like Brecht illustrates some of the questions maybe we have in this pitching class in 2024, where we have a lot of really exciting arms and pure arm talent. But at the same time, that's coupled with pitching profiles that carry a lot of reliever risk. And I think Brecht would maybe like typify that.
Yeah, I mean, he is, I'd say, one of, if not the most exciting arm in the country outside of Chase Burns, just from a sheer stuff standpoint. I mean, he's really a two pitch guy at this point. It's fastball, slider. But he's super, super athletic. He's a former wide receiver on the Iowa football team. Again, super athletic at 6'4", 220, moves well on the mound, super quick arm. I think the key for him is just going to be, honestly, like continued polish and reps. Like, this is his first fall baseball season because he was on the football team the last two falls. This will be the first year that he can solely focus on baseball, which I think will be a key. And like you cited, a big thing with him is going to be developing that command and control and having that take a step forward, because the walk rate has always been high. Strike throwing has always been a little bit of a bugaboo. But focusing on just the pitch types alone, the fastball, I mean, he'll pitch in the 97 to 101 range. There were a couple, the guns were hot, but I mean, a couple of stadium guns had him at 102 and 103. Like, it is as explosive as it gets. It's probably, you know, it's at least a 70 pitch just on velocity alone, but it has some life to it. It had, I think that this past spring, it had a 28% miss rate, which is really impressive for a heater.
Yep.
And then I think that the slider, again, I'd slap a 70 on it at this point. It is it's just demonic. It's in the high 80s. It's got a ton of two plane bite, 53% miss rate. He'll throw it to both righties and lefties and make each type of hitter look absolutely silly with it. But when you kind of peel back and look under the hood a little bit, past the exciting pure stuff that he has, again, you're looking at right now a two pitch guy. There's a ton of reliever risk. I think that developing a third pitch, you know, whether that's a changeup or a more distinct looking curveball, is going to be a key for Brecht. And I'm pretty confident in that. Coach Sean McGrath, Iowa's pitching coach, does an excellent job with all of his arms. And I think that getting his hands on Brecht for a fall season in the full lead up to the spring is going to be huge. And I wouldn't be shocked to see him come out with an improved repertoire. He'll anchor that Hawkeye rotation with another exciting arm in Marcus Morgan. But I mean, the upside with Brecht is unbelievable. And you're looking at, I think in terms of pitchers in the draft, he might have the highest ceiling of anyone. It's just about like adding polish, again, adding a third pitch and teams being sold on his starter ability.
Yeah, I think you made a really just great point when you talked about this being his first fall, really focus on baseball and focus on pitching. That's just monumentally exciting to me, because when you have players who are either two-way guys and put down the bat or are multi-sport athletes and they start really focusing on baseball only, I really think that there's a lot of strides you can take in a pretty short amount of time, particularly for pitchers, actually. Just the athleticism that he has as a foundation, like the arm talent that he's shown while also not focusing 100% of his time on learning how to pitch is pretty scary. You mentioned the arm speed. I think he hasn't even fully learned how to incorporate his lower half yet. Sometimes it looks like it's just upper half dominant, if that makes sense, when he's on the mound. Like, the fact that he's able to throw as hard as he can in my mind without fully using the lower half is just crazy. But yeah, he does need to improve quite a bit in terms of the command. You mentioned adding a third pitch. He basically threw the slider 49% of the time last year, the fastball 48% of the time, barely used the changeup. I think he threw one that was like low 90s, didn't have really good feel for it. Even though I probably wouldn't expect him to use a third pitch more than like 10% of the time, and that seems optimistic. Like, just showing that a little bit more, showing that he's got some feel for it, showing that can be a pitch that as he gets into pro ball can be a usable offering for him, I think will do a lot to encourage teams that he can start at the next level with more time. Just improving, even if he's never going to be a command pitcher, which I would be surprised if that was a case, like upping the strike rate overall. It was 58% strikes with the slider, 56% strikes with the fastball. Both of those would be below average numbers. I think he's been able to get away with just how filthy the stuff is, inducing chase with his slider, inducing a lot of swing and miss overall. Against better hitters, they're going to stay within the zone. He's going to have to attack them in the zone. But I do think it's encouraging that he doesn't really let up home runs sometimes with pitchers who have really good stuff, but maybe not the best command and control. They can be a little homer prone at times. He only gave up 2 home runs, I think maybe in his career. Yeah, in his career at Iowa, he's just allowed 2 home runs. It's a 64% ground ball rate. So there are a lot of things to like about him, even though we acknowledge that there's a lot of improvement that needs to come. So I'm really excited to see how he looks next spring, if the delivery looks any different at all, how the strikes evolve, and what the pitch mix looks like. Because it is a bit odd to see a starting pitcher at the top of our board here with a slider usage rate that's basically 50%. I would have to look back at recent draft classes and see, like, top pitcher off the board, how high their secondary rate was. Because that seems like kind of a scary number for me, to be honest.
Yeah, it was an interesting one because I knew that he threw his slider a ton and almost leaned on it at times. I didn't expect it, the usage to be more than his heater. But again, you made a great point, I think, with the delivery, especially at least what I saw in the lower half. Like, you could get a little bit more into it. There's stuff to clean up in general. But like with this velocity, obviously you see a ton of effort usually with guys with this premium velo. I mean, it looks like he's playing catch. And 97 to 101, it is a low stress, I'd say, delivery for the most part. And going back to the changeup, I would not be shocked to see it really take a step forward or for him to really show it at all this spring. There is one game in particular I remember. I think it was against Texas Tech, and it was against Gavin Cash. He turned over a really good changeup. I think it was like 90 or 91, but it had a ton of tumble to it. He maintained his arm speed well, and then we never really saw it again. So I think he's got it in there, and I wouldn't be shocked this fall at all if that's what he's working on. But again, with just more refinement and cleaning up in general, he's got a chance to really take a stranglehold on that number one pitcher position. But not to foreshadow to next week, I think Chase Burns is right on his heels, and maybe at this point someone I'd prefer. I think I'm more convicted on him as a starter. And then, of course, you talk about him now being at the pitching factory that is Wake Forest. I'm excited about what Chase Burns looks like this spring would be, I'd say, the understatement of the century.
Yeah, absolutely. And then even looking at what Brody Brecht was doing with Team USA this summer, it was just fastball slider for him. The game that he pitched, I was on the open side really watching hitters, so I didn't have the best overall look at him, but it was kind of what you would expect. There were spurts where he would dominate and hitters would look silly and he generated a lot of ugly swings. And then the next inning he would come out and he would spike balls in the ground, just a little bit more erratic and all over the place. So if he can add some more polish, really the sky is the limit for him. You talk about the upside that he has being some of the best in the class. I don't doubt that at all. It's just elite, elite, pure arm talent. I would like to feel a little bit more convicted in his chance to start at least, because I really wouldn't want to take a reliever in the first round, but maybe that's the class we're looking at in 2024. Any final thoughts on Brecht or really any of the final five guys to kind of put a bow on this, Peter? This has been a lot of fun.
Yeah, I totally agree. And talking through it has made me realize like how interesting this class has a chance to be. And then like on the pitching side, again, with Brecht, I'd say if you're looking for a starter at this point, it's Burns. Upside, obviously, I think, I don't know about obviously, but it's Brecht. It's going to be, no pun intended, an arms race to see who establishes themselves as this number one arm in the class, or if someone else like a Hagen Smith is really able to emerge. But it's going to be a really fun cycle, I think. Like there are, even just talking about it now, there are a number of ways that this thing could shake out at the top, even with guys that we haven't talked about yet that we'll get into in the next couple weeks.
Yeah. Let's cross our fingers for health for all these guys, because it does seem like it's a bit of a just inevitable that once the season starts, or even really before the season, once people start gearing up, the injuries start happening. It always sucks, but it's just kind of something you have to deal with in baseball. But hopefully we can get a good year and have fewer injuries than normal, because it's just always such a bummer when that happens. But yeah, fingers crossed for good luck for all these guys, but especially the pitchers. So that does it for today. Those are the players that we wrapped up. Again, let us know who sounds exciting to you guys based on this conversation. Who do you like? Who are we light on? Who are we high on? How would you line up the top five? Because I do think you could line it up in any number of orders this year, and you really wouldn't get too much pushback from me at this point. So that's part of what's going to make this class fun, as we've talked about a few times here on the podcast. So for you, Peter, what's next coming up? Anything you want to plug or mention before we get out of here?
Yeah, I'll keep rolling along with these freshman spotlight pieces. You can expect them to be out every Monday and Friday. And then podcast with Carlos every Thursday or Friday. This week will be Wednesday. And then in the next couple of weeks, I think Jeff and I are going to hop on to talk through some of the initial signings of the 2024 Cape League season, believe it or not.
You guys are all Cape all the time. I love it. You're as plugged into that league as anyone could possibly be. So that's fantastic. The freshman spotlight pieces are a really good preview of names to know for the next year's college season. So I'd highly recommend those. It's been a blast to just read those for myself, even after covering a lot of those players throughout the spring. Learn a lot from reading Peter's stuff. And today on this podcast, learning a lot about players, just chatting with you about them. So this has been fun. For me, I've got Jupiter coming up this week, which will be the last live baseball that I'll see this spring, or this year, I should say. So I'll have reports on all the players who stood out from that next week. And then, yeah, like Peter said, excited to keep rolling out these draft podcasts into the offseason and getting ready for next year, because it seems crazy to say, but I can start to feel the college season looming here.
Oh yeah. Once you get into fall ball and like these scrimmages start to happen, it becomes way more real. And then once the winter break hits and guys get back and are actually practicing, then you're right there.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. For Peter, I'm Carlos. Thanks for listening, everybody. We appreciate it. Thank you to all the BA subscribers. We will see you next time. Take care.
Meet Charlie. She loves dogs.
Guilty.
She powers her pup empire with Shopify.
The sales won't stop.
With Charlie's tech needs sorted, she can focus on turning her home business into a global operation. Yes, boy, join Shopify, the commerce platform powering millions of businesses worldwide. This is Possibility, powered by Shopify. Sign up for a free trial at shopify.co.uk/green. Go to shopify.co.uk/green to start selling online today.